Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The House is expected to vote on the $1.9 trillion COVID package today, which includes a one-time payment of $1,400 for most households, a continuation of extra unemployment benefits, money for schools and state and local governments, funding for vaccines and COVID testing, and it would include an increase to the child tax credit. That aspect of the bill would greatly reduce child poverty. Of course, this bill is desperately needed. Over 18 million people were receiving weekly unemployment payments through January 30th. Almost 7 million people have experienced some sort of cut in their hours or their wages, according to Heidi Shierholz, former chief economist at the Labor Department. The unemployment crisis is hitting people of color and women the hardest. All of the 140,000 jobs lost in December were held by women, all of them. 9 million small business owners say that they won't survive the pandemic. That is 3 out of every 10 small businesses in this country. By the end of 2020, 50 million people in the U.S. said they didn't have enough food on the table. That is up from 35 million in 2019. So what will it take to pass this bill and get people the help they need? Joining us now is Arthur Delaney, a reporter with HuffPost, where he covers all of these issues. Hi, Arthur. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Arthur, before we dive in and talk about the bill and the politics, can you again give us some context? Remind us of where people are today and how long it has been since they have had enough relief to actually help them pay the bills. And I know it differs based on where you live because unemployment benefits differ depending on what state you're in.
Well, Congress passed a COVID relief bill in December that had those $600 payments. It reauthorized the federal unemployment benefits. So the stuff that they started with in the CARES Act last March has basically continued since then, and it's going to expire. The unemployment benefits will next month. And so they're trying to get this bill done to prevent that from happening, to prevent people from missing benefits, which they may anyway, just because of the way starting and stopping these programs is an administrative problem for states. But I think it's fair to say that, you know, it may not have been enough to make everybody, fully fed and safe and sheltered. But the Congress has been continuously getting money out there, and this is basically a continuation of that. Although it's more money because Democrats are in charge now.
Yeah, and I also really want to talk a little bit about low-wage earners, Arthur, because the way that this is framed is through the lens of politics. The Republicans think it's too big. The Democrats want this with the $15 minimum wage increase. And I just wish that low-wage workers would get more attention because according to Brookings, 44% of U.S. workers, 44% make less than $18,000 a year. You've profiled so many of these people. And I was just reading this incredible piece in the New York Times about a young woman, Catherine Stewart. She's a single mom. She's been homeless. She worked at a gas station in rural Michigan. And she was absolutely floored when she got that extra unemployment check because it was more than what she made. And we heard this argument from Republicans for months and months and months. We can't give people more than what they made. Well, she was making nothing to begin with. And so with this extra money, she said, for the first time, I wasn't stressed. I could actually feed my son. I was actually able to buy him a toy for Christmas. And, you know, reading this, it just speaks to the fact that so many people are really struggling, even before COVID.
That's right. I think there's a lot going on. We're in a moment where politics is changing. And last year, because of the pandemic, Congress really gave people a taste of a Democratic government responding to their needs.
Right.
Lawmakers snapped their fingers, boom, thousands of dollars in your bank accounts, either from the direct payments to virtually everybody beneath a certain income level or the expanded unemployment benefits. We've had an unemployment system for almost 100 years, and it's a state-federal thing. It's complicated. and it's basically been allowed to atrophy that whole time. And then all of a sudden, because of the pandemic, they gave it a huge jolt, an extra $600 that it was. They chose that number because it was the difference between the average unemployment benefit and the average wage. In other words, they're going to actually make sure people still have the money they had before, and in many cases, even more money, because there's a plague. And if you were to go out and try to work, you might get sick and die or spread it to someone else. There's just no way to handle the pandemic. So it made a lot of sense, and it made people's lives easier. And they're trying not to drop the ball by discontinuing that way of governing. And they're trying also, the Democrats are now trying to entrench it. There's stuff in this bill that would make monthly payments to parents potentially a permanent thing that the government does. I mean, other governments and other rich countries already recognize that parenting is hard and it's hard to work, and you need money in order for your children not to be poor and suffer deprivation. And finally, in the United States, we're toying with a recognition of that. We're going to actually give people money so they aren't miserable. And this is basically a make or break moment. And it looks like they're going to actually make it happen.
So let's talk about this, because this would be life changing for moms like Catherine, who struggles to feed her son. This bill would increase the maximum value of the child tax credit to $3,600 from $2,000 and eliminate earnings requirements. And that means that low income households would benefit even if they don't have jobs.
Right. So they're taking this obscure thing in the tax code that mainly benefits wealthy people and, you know, reduces their tax bill, and saying, let's make it so that this tax credit gives everybody money, even if they don't have a tax bill, even if they didn't earn anything. And so there's a lot of questions about what this will ultimately look like. It's possible the Senate rules will interfere with Democrats' ability to get it through, and they haven't put on paper that it would last for more than 1 year. But what it would do is give practically everyone who would get a stimulus check would also get thousands of dollars for each child they have per year. And potentially they would break this up so that it's paid monthly. It's a child allowance where you get $300 or so a month for each child you have. It would really revolutionize the relationship between families and the federal government in this country.
And the woman who has been behind this for 17 years is Congresswoman Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat from Connecticut. I mean, she's been pushing this since 2003. There was a really interesting piece at the Connecticut Mirror about how she holds house parties. Elizabeth Warren first got involved with policy after meeting Rosa DeLauro. And she says that this would greatly reduce poverty, especially for Native children, Latino children, and Black children. And obviously, white poor children.
They're not making stuff up. They're not winging it. This is something that's an established style of governing in every other rich country. That, you know, every when parents have kids, they get a child allowance or child benefit or tax credit that gives them cash. And we've had only sort of complicated tax based versions of this, where if you don't actually make money, you don't get it. And they're going to change that. And Democrats are saying this is potentially the most momentous thing in this bill, potentially the most important thing they've done in their whole careers. Mm-hmm. So we're on the precipice of drastically reducing child poverty. And it's just a matter of giving parents money.
And in fact, according to the Center on Poverty and Social Policy, this could cut child poverty in half.
I mean, that's a finding that is, it's not just them. It's like Columbia University researchers all over. The National Academy of Sciences, in a groundbreaking report a few years ago, said, you know, giving parents money would reduce, not only slash child poverty, like immediately, it would have great effects on the economy later on, because people who didn't suffer as children will have happier, more productive lives when they're adults. So it's, there's like, it's a robust finding is what they say. This could be a big deal. And it's thanks to the pandemic spurring lawmakers to give people those checks last year and then do it again in December and do it again with the $1,400 payments that are in this bill, that it's sort of broken a taboo that has long existed on giving people money, even if they don't work.
Right. What are your thoughts specifically about media coverage of this aspect of the bill, that this would have such a great effect on poverty in this country? And are you seeing more stories about how families are having such a tough time just feeding their children?
I do think there are a lot of stories about that. I don't know if you were thinking we had neglected this one. I know at HuffPost and New York Times and Washington Post, LA Times, there is definitely coverage of this. And it's a little weird because it's kind of a novel thing. Mm-hmm. And Democrats, you know, we don't know what it's going to happen. I'm actually afraid that we might be hyping this possible change too much. Like we still have to see the follow through. We still have to see, first of all, we have to see the bill passed. That seems pretty likely. But then we have to see the implementation by the IRS. That could be tricky. Then we have to see Democrats entrench this and make it something that that happens year after year. So a lot has to happen. And what we're doing right now is very theoretical. We're saying if you give people money, it'll slash child poverty and drastically improve people's lives. And now we're approaching the point where that's actually got to happen, or we'll look like fools.
And how much is this specifically costing?
So this is a $2 trillion bill, and about a quarter of that is those one-time payments. A quarter of it is the unemployment benefits, and then there's all this money for states and a little bit for vaccines and stuff. And this is just squeaking in there at like $100 billion. So it's like 5% of the cost, but that's because they are trying to keep it under $2 trillion. It's $1.9 trillion. Like you're at a dollar store, and they want to make it. You know, they don't want to go over that $2 trillion barrier. Right. So they were sort of cheap, and that's how much it costs for 1 year. They intended to be permanent. It would cost a lot more if the budget scorekeepers looked at its 10-year costs. So it's a major thing, but they're only giving it a toehold in the federal budget with how they've put it in this bill.
So this specific aspect that would cut child poverty in half would cost about $150 billion a year?
It's in the neighborhood of $100 billion. It's not chump change. It's an expensive thing, and it's nothing to sneeze at. And they may have to find a way to make it permanent in a subsequent bill to offset its cost. One idea would be to maybe collapse other existing programs into it, or maybe pair it with a tax hike of some kind. They're not there yet. I asked senators yesterday, like, how are you going to make this permanent if you get it in this bill and it only lasts for a year? What's the plan? And they don't have a plan yet. But they said, you know, we're going to slash child poverty. To not preserve that would be to essentially double child poverty in the following year. And we don't think Republicans will go for that. So it's a big question mark right now.
So, you know, I have to say, Arthur, whenever I hear about Republicans asking how do we pay for it, I think about the tax cut they passed for the wealthy in 2017. It was about $2 trillion, right? Are you hearing from Democrats about what they want to do about that tax cut for the wealthy and corporations? Because that money could pay for this.
They are not talking about that, except that I do believe they would be hesitant to just cancel that whole bill. Like a lot of the cost, the deficit impact of that bill was from tax cuts that went all the way down the income ladder. You know, even though much of it went skewed toward corporations and the wealthy, that's tough for them to get rid of. And they don't have to, I mean, that bill, because of the way it wrote, itself expires. Like it only lasts until 2025. And Democrats just aren't really there yet. They're not talking about what parts of it they want to undo, except for this one sort of obscure mortgage, this local property tax thing that Democrats are obsessed with. The rest of that bill, they're not talking about just rooting it out.
Today, we're talking about the $1.9 trillion relief bill that the House will be voting on today with Arthur Delaney, reporter with HuffPost. Arthur will be with us for about 10 or so more minutes. So if you have any questions about this bill, any thoughts about media coverage, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Let's talk about the $1,400 direct payment. This sum is meant to top off the $600 check, so that would be a total of $2,000. Can you give us an update on this? If this passes, when will people see this money?
People would see this money in a matter of weeks. I'm talking a big game about how the child tax credit changes would reduce poverty, but like this huge pile of cash coming right to you in like a matter of weeks, that's going to reduce poverty too. And so would the $400 federal unemployment benefits supplement. This is all major poverty reducing stuff. I don't know if people realize how much money is coming to them, because in that first bill, there was a $1,200 payment and then you got $500 per kid. In this one, it's $1,400 for each person and each dependent. So that's really going to add up. And then it doesn't phase out for a household. It doesn't completely disappear until a household income is above $200,000. So like most people are going to get these pretty large checks, which I believe are unprecedented in U.S. history. Like in the Bush years, there were rebates that were worth a few hundred dollars, but nothing like this.
Hmm. What about small businesses? So many small businesses are still struggling. How would they benefit from this? Small business owners benefit from this bill, and also sole proprietors, because I know so many of our listeners own their own business.
They have more small business tax credits in this. And I believe there's another tranche of PPP money, but I have covered that a little less. I have to confess, I'm not prepared to get into the weeds on that aspect of it.
And then what about money for local and state governments? NPR has been interviewing a number of mayors around the country this week, and a lot of them say we just don't have the money to pay our firefighters, for example. We don't have the money to fix our roads. Have you been looking at that aspect of the bill?
This has been something that Republicans have been complaining about a lot, right? Because there's a chunk of money in there to address state budget projected shortfalls. And the projected shortfalls have turned out to be not as bad as initially feared. And this money may help more. I mean, it certainly helps states avoid laying off public service personnel, but it's resulted in this sort of damaging talking point, I guess, for Republicans. But it's going to be a big help for states.
Yeah, a huge help for states. And then the other one is the minimum wage. So let's talk about what's happened to the minimum wage. Can you just describe the process involved in all of this? Because a lot of people, you know, like the parliamentarian says that the $15 minimum wage will not be allowed in the relief bill as written under Senate rules. What does that mean exactly?
It's nonsense. I mean, they might as well say due to magic, we can do this, but not the other thing in this bill. It's based on an obscure budget law that Congress passed a few decades ago. And they basically arbitrarily say you can do all this tax stuff and this other spending in here, but this thing about raising the federal minimum wage is extraneous. And so the Senate parliamentarian said you can't include it, and they could fire the parliamentarian or they could overrule the parliamentarian, but that's just not Joe Biden's style. And so now Democrats today are saying we have a plan B, and it entails a tax on corporations who underpay their workers. It's not the most compelling stuff. It basically the federal minimum wage is going to stay at $7.25 an hour. And that prevails in 20 states. Other states have raised their own minimum wage, but it's going to wind up having to be a whole separate fight.
So I want to ask you about something that David Sirota over at the Daily Poster is reporting. He writes that on Thursday, so we talked about the parliamentarian. He writes that as the presiding officer of the Senate, Vice President Kamala Harris can now use the power her predecessors have used to ignore the advisory opinion and fulfill Biden's campaign promise to boost the wage. Can you just talk about, do you know about how this works? He writes that White House Chief of Staff Ron Klain declared that Harris will refuse to use that power, a decision that would effectively put the Biden-Harris administration in the position of potentially killing the prospect. Immediately after the parliamentarian's ruling, the White House issued a statement reiterating Klain's comment, declaring that Biden respect the parliamentarian's decision. So what kind of power does Kamala Harris have here?
Yeah, they could just reject the parliamentarian, or they could fire the parliamentarian and get a new one who says it's okay. That's something that Republicans did in 2001 when they were working on the Bush tax cuts. But that's just not Joe Biden's style. He's a former senator, and he campaigned partially on this idea of unity, and it's just doesn't feel unifying to him to disregard the parliamentarian at this time. You know, to be honest, I was surprised when they put $15 minimum wage in this bill, and he has telegraphed the whole time that it would run into this problem and that he would not fight it. It's almost like something it's almost like they want to look like they're sacrificing this, and you know, as though they're giving something up and being reasonable and taking what they can get. But the truth is they could have it all if they really wanted.
Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Bill in San Francisco. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. How much have the tax cuts since 2000 affected the wealthy, and how much have the deep recession of 2008, 2009, 2010 and the current COVID and all the disasters, the major fires, the Katrina, affected poverty in America, especially for people of color?
Well, I just found a number for you, and then we can get Arthur to respond. According to the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, since 2000, Congress passed several rounds of tax cuts that have increased the deficit by $6 trillion, $6 trillion with a T, and disproportionately benefited the top 20% of households, which received two-thirds, 65% of all tax changes. Arthur, this is such an important question. Why do you think this doesn't get more attention? It seems like when a politician comes on and says, this is too expensive, we can't cut child poverty in half. Well, explain this, $6 trillion in tax cuts for the wealthy since 2000.
Your answer is so good, Rose, with those numbers. I think Democrats have realized something after they went through the Obama years and then the Trump years. So in the Obama years, Republicans were like, oh man, $20 billion for the unemployed. We absolutely must not add this to the deficit. And then they passed this gigantic tax cut bill. And then they've on a dime switched back to saying we can't add any more to the deficit of the national debt. And Democrats are just not taking it seriously. And economists are not taking it seriously. And that's why this $2 trillion bill is about to happen. And everyone's going to get a $1,400 check. And we're potentially going to have a revolutionary child allowance. That also shows the limit of the change that has occurred, because Democrats are still buckling to the cost pressures and not willing to make their bill cost more than it does. But I think a lot has changed, and a lot of lessons have been learned by many different parties, and the deficit scolding that prevailed in the Obama years is just not effective anymore at all. And the economists on the outside don't think that the national debt is the threat that they did. They don't know when the inflation rate will go up as a result of spending. They used to say, oh, it's always around the corner. We're definitely in a new place now in terms of politics and political economy.
And Arthur, when we were talking about the child tax credit, you talked about how this is just a no-brainer in Europe. And you reminded me of this piece I read in the New York Times about two opera singers, one in Germany, one in the United States. The one in the United States is really struggling. He's actually taking coding classes. He doesn't even know if he'll remain an opera singer because he's just struggling to make ends meet. The opera singer in Germany is earning $3,050 a month. 80% of his wages is paid by the German government, and the opera makes up the rest. So he's not struggling at all, and he has universal health care.
Yeah, Congress created all these big benefits. There's this big PPP business program that has had three or four iterations. There were these checks, and there were these big unemployment benefits, but they all sort of ran out. I think they compare favorably to what Europe has done, but it's been a matter of will Congress reauthorize them or extend them, and we have a less certain outcome. And also, they're all these programs are way less universal than they might be over in Europe. But I wouldn't sell short what Congress has managed to do and what they're about to do. It's pretty big money, and for the people who receive it, it's nothing to sneeze at. But there are going to be those examples where it's not as good, and we haven't done things like make sure that people whose occupations obviously don't work in a pandemic are able to just have money and wait for the pandemic to go away, which it looks like it will. We have the vaccine on the horizon, and people who work in restaurants, bars, or who perform are having to scrape together what they can and pray that their benefits don't run out. And it's terrible, because if someone has a vocation that they love, they shouldn't have to lose it when it could come back in a matter of months.
Exactly. And just briefly, Arthur, the House is supposed to vote today. What are you hearing from senators? What's next?
So what I've heard from senators is the House will vote today, and then the House bill comes over to the Senate. They're not doing their own bill that then has to merge with the House bill, and they're not going to have committee by committee markups of the House bill. So I think things are going to move pretty fast, except the roadblock in the Senate is there's things like the minimum wage and potentially a few other things that will get stricken by the parliamentarian. So there'll be a Senate vote and then probably another vote in each chamber. And I do think it looks like it will wrap up before the March 14 deadline when unemployment benefits begin to expire again. And the minimum wage going away actually may make this easier for Democrats, because they had Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema in Arizona who didn't really favor the $15. And so without it, they're probably it's easier for them to vote yes.
Arthur Delaney is a reporter with HuffPost, where he covers these issues. Arthur, thanks so much for your reporting, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Coming up after a break, we will speak with Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. He'll join us from Rome to talk about the vaccine rollout in Europe. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Now I'd like to welcome Eric Reguli to the show. Eric is the European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. He's based in Rome, and he is coming out with a book called Ghosts of War, My Father's Vietnam Odyssey. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you, Eric. It's wild to think that we had you on pretty much this time last year. And I remember just feeling so overwhelmed by reporting the high numbers of the deaths coming out of Italy. The country was hit the hardest during the earliest days of the pandemic. Tragically, 95,000 people have died. People say that the number could be much higher. Overall, I mean, how are you reflecting a year later, Eric?
Well, I'm starting to lose hope again. I was, in this time last year when we talked, it was genuinely scary because we knew nothing about COVID. We didn't know how lethal it was. All we knew was that it was spreading very, very quickly. We didn't know whether it was going to kill 10% of us, 5% of us, 1% of us. And then by the summer, it seemed over, and we opened up again, which is a big mistake. And then the cases started to climb. And now certainly in the European Union and Italy, less so in the UK, we're getting very scared again. Why? Because the vaccines aren't here in enough quantities, and the cases are starting to shoot up again, and the new variants are coming. So I wouldn't say we're as afraid as we were, Rose, a year ago, but I have no confidence that this pandemic is anywhere near over.
Are you all still under lockdown there?
Well, in Italy, yes and no. It's a complicated question. We have a three-zone system, red, orange, yellow. So the hot spots are red. And that is a full lockdown. Orange and yellow, less so. Rome is yellow, but some spots are going into the medium emergency category. You're still okay. Look, everything closes at 6 o'clock. There's a curfew at 10 o'clock. Interregional travel is not allowed. But still, during the daytime, you can go out, you can exercise, the bars are open. So it doesn't feel too bad in Rome, but the hot spots, cities and towns, it feels like it did early last year.
So give us a sense. First, we'll talk about Italy, and then we'll talk about Europe. Talk about the vaccine rollout in Italy. What does that look like?
Well, it's slow, but you can't really talk about individual countries, Rose, because individual countries in the European Union, which is 27 countries, are not buying their own vaccines. So Italy only jabs people depending on the shipments it gets. It's allotment. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a per capita arrangement. So what happened was, in the early summer, the European Commission, which is the executive arm of the European Union, said, okay, guys, we're gonna buy all the vaccines for all of the EU. Seemed to make sense at the time. Because one buyer, buying power, mass buying. And that way there wouldn't be wars between Germany and Spain and Italy and France to get first dibs. But they completely botched it. And the reasons are, if one reason is the European Union, the European Commission, moved way too slowly. They waited 3 months after the UK before they bought their vaccines. They got bogged down in bureaucracy. They got bogged down in negotiating liability for the vaccines. They got bogged down in the enforcement mechanisms for the vaccines. In other words, if the vaccines were late, what retaliation measures there were. And the whole thing's been a scandal.
Wow. The EU says its target is to vaccinate 70% of the population by September. Well, now we're at almost March. Do you think that they'll be able to carry that out, given the problems you're talking about?
Well, I don't. It's a good question. I don't really know. There's no doubt that the vaccine rate is starting to increase now as new supplies come in. But still, I'm just looking at the Bloomberg vaccine tracker. The EU as a whole has vaccinated fewer than 7 people out of every 100. So it's fewer than 7%. So they got a long way to go. If you look at the UK, they're at 29%. Israel, 86%. Chile, 17%. Morocco is even ahead of the EU at 9%. So got a long way to go. But, there is such political pressure now to get these vaccines out that I think there's a good chance they will get to 70% by that date. The question is, that's a long time, and how many mutations are we going to see before then? Already in Italy, 20 or 30% of all the new cases are the UK variant, which is more deadly and more contagious. In some parts of Italy, it's as high as 60% already.
And I have to just mention, Eric, you talked about Israel's high vaccination rate. It's really important to point out that Palestinians are not getting shots. The New York Times just had a piece a couple days ago about how the Israeli government has pledged to send thousands of spare vaccines to foreign allies, and yet Palestinians are not getting the vaccinations.
Yeah, that's true. And I've been to Palestine several times, and my heart does go out for them because, you know, they're under occupation. And my view anyway is that they should be vaccinated with doses from Israel. Israel's point of view is that the Palestinian Authority, that is the Palestinians' authority to do the buy and administer the vaccinations.
Right. Israel, according to the Times, has given 2,000 doses to the Palestinian Authority so far. This is something that we should definitely cover on a future Friday show. What about the rollout itself? I'm sure that you've read about what's happening in the United States. It's getting somewhat better, but people are still having a really hard time getting appointments. What does that look like where you are? You just wrote a piece actually called How Are Rich Italians Jumping the Vaccination Queue?
Okay, so overall, I think the vaccination rollout, other than the fact there is a terrible shortage of vaccines, is sensible. It's been communicated well. They started with the most vulnerable, who are those, the over 85s. And the medics, the doctors and nurses who have just, they've been slaughtered here. So far, there's been about 320 doctors, frontline doctors have died in Italy. I don't have the number for the nurses, I'm sorry. But it's pretty high as well. So all the oldest people, hospital workers, doctors. So that's all they've done so far. They're starting to do teachers now. Teachers are in there. So that all makes sense. But when we're going to get to the over 70s and the over 60s, I mean, Italy, the problem with Italy is that it's got one of the oldest populations in the world, which is one of the reasons why the fatality rate from COVID-19 is so high here. So, you know, this shortage of vaccines is really bad because we have not vaccinated in Italy and throughout Europe, the most vulnerable. So India, 2% of people are over 65, I think. That number's more or less right. In Italy, it's something like 30%. So you can see how much more vulnerable Italy is.
You know, Eric, a lot of people in the United States say one of the problems is because we don't have any sort of universal healthcare system, we're all just kind of looking at 15 different, well, not that many, let's say 5 to 10 different websites to figure out where to sign up. In fact, I was looking for my dad, you know, CVS, Walgreens, his doctor doesn't have them yet, the public health website. In Europe, where there is some sort of national health plan, is the system working better because of that? Has it made a difference?
So. Yeah. Absolutely, Rose. There's no confusion about how to get a vaccine. There's in Italy, there is a single website. You put in your, it's called a codice fiscale. That means it's like your social insurance number. So you put in this number. It's got all your data there, and it says you're too early, or yes, you can get your vaccine now. Here's your date. Simple as that. Hmm. I had an interesting story. A couple of weeks ago, I interviewed Annalisa Malata. Annalisa Malata is the doctor in Northern Italy who found and confirmed the first European COVID-19 case. That was on February 20th, 2020. This is when no one in Europe had any idea that COVID was even here. And she was suspected that all the flu cases in her town were not really flu, that they were COVID. And she has become a national hero and wrote a book. I asked her, I said, what is the biggest lesson you learned in the year of treating patients? And she said, the biggest lesson I learned is you have to have a national healthcare system, and you have to invest in it to make sure it's robust enough to handle a pandemic.
Wow. That speaks volumes.
Well, I think so. Yeah. You know, I'm Canadian. You know, we have national health in Canada. It's in Europe, but you know, it's helped a lot having these national health systems, but certainly in Italy, it's been underfunded. It wasn't prepared. The German system was a bit better. The French system was a bit better. The British system was a disaster because of underfunding. There wasn't PPE. There wasn't enough beds. And Italy was not as bad as the UK, but it was the underfunding, especially in northern Italy, where a lot of the money was bled off into the parallel private system, really damaged the early response.
Today, we're speaking with Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Eric is based in Rome and is author of the forthcoming book, Ghosts of War, My Father's Vietnam Odyssey. I'll ask you to give us a little preview before we end about your book, Eric. If you have any questions for Eric about what is happening in Europe with the vaccine rollout and COVID, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Eric, we have an email from Bill who says, I've heard that some countries in Europe allow their citizens to attend events and movies and theaters if they carry cards that show they received the vaccine. Will tourists need comparable cards from their own countries to travel to European countries?
Okay, complicated question. I don't have all the answer. There is a big debate in Europe, Rose, about vaccine passports and whether they're discriminatory, whether they should be allowed at all, because, you know, we haven't talked about, there's a very big anti-vax movement in Europe, especially in France. Mm-hmm. And that's also slowing the rollout. So you have that factor. Many pregnant women are afraid to get the vax, probably for legitimate reasons, because most of these vaccines haven't been tested on pregnant women. So there's these issues. I think how the debate is coalescing, what I would like to see is a uniform standard across the EU instead of you having, you know, 27 different vaccine passport standards. And it would just be a huge confusing mess that would probably cause more damage. But we're not anywhere near that yet. This is probably months away before we have some common standard.
Well, thank you for the question, Bill. We haven't even begun this debate in the United States yet, Eric, and I can only imagine how intense it's going to get. It's like when you go to a concert, will the venue require some sort of proof? I mean, it's just going to be fascinating to see how this all rolls out. Eric, I also wanted to ask you about Italy's new prime minister, Mario, is it Draghi?
Mario Draghi, yes, you have it right. Very good.
Well, thank you. What can you tell us about Mario Draghi?
Oh, well, he's supposed to be our savior. Okay, Mario Draghi is he's 73. He's the former president of the European Central Bank. Wasn't until last year. He became a hero in the EU and the Eurozone because when he started in 2011, the European Union was ready to unravel. Greece, you probably remember, was bankrupt and bailed out and ready to get kicked out of the euro. Italy wasn't far behind. Debt crisis, austerity, and he kept, without going into detail, because I cover this intimately, I could talk about it for years, bore everyone to death, but he'd saved the euro from destruction. And so he's got a lot of street cred in that sense. He didn't want the job in Italy, but he did it out of patriotic duty. The last government, governments in Italy last an average year, collapsed. And the president, who's the head of state, press ganged him into the job. So he's starting. Remarkably, he's united this fractious parties. So we have a unity government in place. Two goals: get everyone vaccinated as fast as possible, and save this country from economic destruction. I mean, the recession here is ugly and sad.
We talked about that last time you were on, Eric. We were just talking about the small businesses, how people are really struggling. What do you think will change with Mario Draghi in office?
Well, I think that what he can do is stabilize Italy's finances. It's a heavily indebted country. It's running a big deficit. And there's so much confidence in him in the global debt markets, the bond markets, that the hope is that with Mario Draghi in charge, in other words, a man who knows about economics, about money, about debt, who's not insane, who is not associated with a political party, who has vast experience, has a lot of calming effect on the international debt markets. So he's got to keep people buying Italian bonds. I think that'll work. I'm not so confident about what you and I just talked about, the vaccine rollout. To me, it's largely out of his hands. It's because Italy isn't buying its own vaccines. That's up to the European Commission, and there's just not a lot. And what can he do about it? I mean, nothing as far as I can see.
Gosh, and then you have to think about all of the, you know, countries that don't have access. I have some friends in Honduras, and they said, we can't even get testing, let alone the vaccine. We have no idea when it's coming, they said. So,
well, yeah.
You know.
The first shipments to Africa, to sub-Saharan Africa, excluding South Africa, just happened a few days ago, 2 days ago, I think. I think the first COVID shipments were to the shipments were to Ghana. So, you know, most 130 countries have not had a single vax.
Wow. That deserves so much more attention. Also, Eric, I wanted to ask you, how are European countries dealing with the economic crisis? This article in the New York Times really, really struck me about this opera singer in Germany and opera singer in New York. And the opera singer in Germany has universal health care and is still receiving a monthly check. Whereas, of course, the opera singer in the United States is really struggling to make ends meet. What does that look like in Europe? Whereas here, you know, it's taken so long for any sort of relief people got relief last year, but they've just been in limbo for so many months. What does it look like in Europe?
Well, it depends on each country, but generally speaking, Rose, it's employment, it's payments to keep people in their jobs. So the money is given to companies, and the companies use it to pay their workers. It's working pretty well. It's not preventing, you know, small businesses from going bankrupt, but at least you can feed yourself. And also having national health care helps. You know, it's, if you get sick, you know, it's not going to cost you anything. It's not going to cost you anything to get a jab, that sort of thing. The problem is that this is only sustainable for so long because governments only have so much money. And, you know, look at Italy's debt to GDP has gone up from 130%. To 160% in 1 year, which is atrocious because of all, you know, all the payments for you know, to keep people topped up, and so it can't last much longer, which is why this pandemic has to end. We have to get people back to work.
Right. Eric, in our remaining 2 minutes, can you give us a brief synopsis of your forthcoming book, Ghosts of War, My Father's Vietnam Odyssey?
Okay, brief, yes. In 1967, when I was a wee little boy, my father, who was a very famous Canadian journalist, and he worked for the Toronto Star, we were living in Chevy Chase, Maryland. It was first foreign posting. Went to Vietnam for a few months and saw a lot of carnage and death and violence. My father was a madman. He was completely fearless. He was a paratrooper, big, burly guy. And what was really scary is we didn't know from day to day whether he was alive. This is before mobile phones, before internet. And we don't even know if he was alive when we saw his byline in the newspaper the next day. And even then, you know, because there's a lag. He died 10 years ago. I went through all his stories, notes, photographs, and 3 years ago, I retraced his journey in Vietnam. I spent a month there, went to all the battle zones he went to, interviewed people, looked at the areas, you know, what do they look like? They don't look like battle zones anymore, that's for sure. And that became a Globe and Mail article of 10,000 words. A publisher approached me and I just turned it into a book. It's finished, it's being edited now, it'll be published later this year, and I'm really excited about it.
Well, congratulations, Eric. We'd love to have you on when your book comes out.
Thank you. That'd be great.
Well, Eric, as always, thank you for your reporting, and I hope you and your loved ones and your family stay safe. We'd love to have you on soon.
Okay. Thank you, Rose. Anytime. It was a great pleasure.
Thank you. Eric Regoli is the European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail based in Rome. The title of his forthcoming book is Ghosts of War, My Father's Vietnam Odyssey. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Also go to yourcallradio.org and sign up for our podcast. You can also listen to all of our past shows there. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Joanne Marr and Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And coming up on Monday, we are going to talk about a new Mother Jones investigation about the gas industry's campaign to convince households to use gas stoves. The industry is also involved in anti-electrification campaigns across the country. Natural gas contributes to climate change and air pollution. And then later in the show, we will talk about the historic nomination of Congresswoman Deb Haaland to head the Interior Department. If she's confirmed, and right now it looks like she will be the first Native American to ever head a cabinet agency. I hope you can join us on Monday. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.